Friday afternoon. You're tuned to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 on the occupied territories of the Anishinaabe and Mihiyawak, the historical territory of the displaced Nakota, also the current home of the Dakota and members of the Dene and Inuit, and the homeland of the Red River Métis. My name is Michael Welch. During the summer months, we've been honoring CKUW's 20 years as a broadcaster on the FM band by airing vintage, locally produced spoken word programming from CKUW's illustrious past. On this, week five, we will be discussing the anarchist show known as Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance. It had aired in a prime slot Wednesday afternoons before actually fading to black in the fall of 2014. It had aired on CKUW since before anyone could tune it in on their radios, making it one of this campus-based broadcaster's longest-running shows. We managed to convene a conversation recently with two of the show's popular and long-standing former hosts. Interwoven with that chat will be excerpts from interviews and programs that appeared during its time in CKUW's stable of programs. Strap on your seatbelts as we take a non-hierarchical ride down memory lane.
My name is Patrick McGuire. I was a host on Black Mask from 1998 till 2003.
My name is Ethan Osland, and I was a host from 2003 until the end of the show in late 2014.
How did the Black Mask concept come into play, and how did it get to CKW?
There were two people in town who I was friends with, John Schlewitz and also Candace Friesen, and they put in an application, I think at the very start, of when it went to FM, and they were going to do an alternating week's shows. And so John's program was called Black Mask, and then Candace's was called Red Cell Radio. And John's kind of focus was kind of more political prisoners and prisoner of war support, and Candace's focus was kind of like a radical feminist left kind of analysis. And I think fairly quickly they both realized that it was going to be a lot of work and a lot of time. And so I think Candace did, it feels like a month or two of shows. And then John was like, hey, can you help me with this thing? And so I stepped in to help him with it. And then I think within a couple months, I was doing it by myself for that first little bit. And so, yeah, I think, you know, from fairly start on, it was, that's what Black Mask was. The catchphrase was revolutionary class struggle and liberation politics. And we called it Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance. And so that's how we started.
Okay. And what maybe some of the early, you mentioned, some of the issues like around prison justice and so on. Did you see in those early years, was there an evolution, and how did that... What may have provoked that?
Sure. Yeah. I think the biggest thing is that both all of us, Candace, John, and myself, had all been involved with the Anarchist Black Cross. So we'd all done political prisoner and prisoner of war support work. And so I think that influenced a lot of what the show was at the start. I remember I was just thinking about on the way here, like, what was some of the stuff we actually broadcast? And for a while, I was actually rebroadcasting Maoist international movement, like radio shows from the United States that were doing stuff on political prisoners, because it was some of the same people we were supporting through the Anarchist Black Cross. But yeah, I would say that it kind of started out with that focus. I think we always explicitly wanted to make it, or at least when I was involved, we always wanted to explicitly make it an anarchist radio program. Like, we were trying to put out anarchist politics and analysis. I think it maybe morphed when I was involved to being trying to be more of kind of a mouthpiece for all elements of the kind of radical left in Winnipeg. So trying to reach out to various other movements and have a platform for people to talk about the organizing and the things they were doing. So that was definitely one of the things that I was conscious of or trying to do with the program.
The government has to take control of housing that slum landlords are running down to the detriment of the health and safety of people. But there seems to be a lack of care on the part of the government simply because those people are poor and therefore their voice doesn't really count.
Yeah. And ultimately, as you're kind of alluding to, I mean, the solutions will come when people finally take control of housing and actually are able to, you know, run it themselves in ways that they actually determine are appropriate for themselves.
It has to be democratic. It has to be something rather than bureaucrats handing out largesse to organizations or groups that seem to make a pretty good living out of administering poverty and putting it directly into the hands of the people that need it. And I think that was one of the problems, too. There was far too much money has been wasted on administration and developing programs that could have gone into direct purchase and renewal and upgrading of the existing housing stock.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm speaking with Harold Dick. He's a Winnipeg advocate for people on low income and poverty through an organization called the Low Income Intermediary Project. Harold, do you have any closing comments before we finish for today?
Only that this is a problem that has very broad social implications. I have a quote on my office wall that simply states that injustice in our society will only be ended when those people who are not affected by it are as outraged as those who are. If we're going to make changes in these types of situations, housing, poverty, hunger, lack of education, illness, all these things, more people have to become socially involved in fighting poverty, working with and assisting people in poverty to get themselves organized and to demand their rights.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Harold.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, thanks.
In the past number of years, homelessness activists and anti-poverty activists have begun speaking about homelessness in Canada as a national disaster, and it's important that we carry forward that language and that message. Housing is a fundamental human right and not an option, and it should be provided as a basic for any member of our society. And if the current system can't provide those basics for every single member of our society, then something is fundamentally wrong with it, and it needs to be changed. Just give me
a black mask. My pathway to the show and into radical politics entirely is responsible to Patrick. The work that Patrick was doing with John and a comrade of theirs, Rhea Julian, who was also a worker at the Mondragon Collective. They had been active with the Anarchist Black Cross. And I specifically remember seeing their table at a propaganda CD release at University of Manitoba in 2000. It was for Today's Empire is Tomorrow's Ashes record release. And I remember speaking with Patrick about that then. And then, you know, we exchanged contact info. And after a couple of interviews, they agreed to allow me to join the collective, and so that was in 2000, I think. And then we did some organizing there on, you know, out of the Old Market Square Autonomous Zone building project on 91 Albert Street above the Mondragon. And after Patrick also threaded me into the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. Within the same time period, within months of each other, of me joining the IWW, not even months, probably the same month, February of 2003, Patrick also said, hey, I need help with this radio program. And I was thrilled to be asked. And then shortly thereafter, or even concurrently, Garth Hardy was also a newer IWW member, and he started working on the show with us as well.
Good day, good day. Welcome to Black Mass, Frequency of Resistance on CKW 95.9 FM. I am your co-host today, Garth Hardy.
Joey Jacob is also here, and so is an Ethan Osland, who you'll be hearing from shortly.
Yeah, and we've got a pretty big show for you folks today. It's our last one before Fun Drive.
That's true.
And what are we doing today? Well, we're going to have an interview with two collective members from the Mondragon. We've got This Day in Radical History. We've got some analysis of the of the, I guess, the controversy surrounding the Muhammad cartoons, our new regular feature, An Action a Day.
And that was the beginning of my association to the station, and you know, and started that threading together in a broad base, the like some of the more radical political activity here in the city. Mm-hmm. On the left of the spectrum, not the radical right, because that would not make any sense.
Let's get to the meat of the issue, as it were. That's my vegan joke for the Mondragon folks that are joining me in the studio. And with me here is Ethan. Say hello.
Hello.
And Kelly.
Hello.
There we go. So, welcome to Black Mask.
Thanks
for having us.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in Winnipeg right now. A lot of people are concerned about the Mondragon, and there's a big fundraising campaign that's sort of on everybody's brain right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope so.
Yes, in fact.
Maybe.
Yeah. I know there are a lot of people that have been, you know, are obviously very concerned about the situation that we'll hopefully have time to get into a little bit later. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could, for our listeners, for their benefit, could you give a bit of background about the collective and how and why it came to be?
Sure. Started in, well, we opened in July of 1996, so this is our 10th anniversary year. It was opened by a few people. One of the main reasons why was what we wanted to do was provide a vegan restaurant, vegetarian restaurant in the city. At that time, I believe there was none. Maybe Delicious was open by then. And then we also wanted to make sure that it had sort of a radical food politics alongside of it, so that we were ordering union-made products, so that we were ordering later on organics, so that it was fair trade coffee, whole bunch of different reasons for, you know, not just providing vegetarian fare, but also sort of bringing in more food politics beyond just vegetarianism. That was one reason. Another reason was I believe the co-op bookstore had just, or like the old communist bookstore had just closed down, I think in like 95 or so. So it left kind of a gaping hole in Winnipeg where there wasn't really an opportunity to get radical, like progressive literature in the city. So we figured we'd start up a bookstore as well as the cafe. People could come grab some books. And
speaking about the Mondragon, I spoke with Sarah Michelson for an earlier mm-hmm. installment of the program, and she mentioned that the early news department meetings were at the Mondragon.
That's right.
And a hub of radical organizing was going on there. And so mm-hmm. you see an intersection of all sorts of different groups, causes going through there. And so that seems like that. You know, I always found that there was a lot of overlapping interests and motivations between the mm-hmm. Mondragon, the now deceased Mondragon, and CKUW generally.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think if you think about the things that we were promoting, or at least that I was promoting at the start of Black Mask, is basically like what was happening at Mondragon, what was happening mm-hmm. at 91 Albert Street in the old market autonomous zone, right? I feel like if there was a group that like had office space at that space that we were inviting them to come to on the show to promote their events, to again, really kind of be a mouthpiece for a lot of those things that were going on out of that space.
Yeah, and both this station and 91 Albert, the A-Zone, as it was affectionately known, those were organizing hubs for a lot of groups, for not just promotion, but also just like education sort of like the IWW talks about agitation, education, integration, and then you have a solidarity movement growing, and it was just a natural mm-hmm. expression of all of that. Without the support of that station, I think a lot of people wouldn't have been able to felt safe enough to express themselves on these subjects. It would have been just a different, not that it wouldn't have happened, it just would have been a lot more different. And I think having that access And the support. I can't stress that enough, I don't think.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I want to really give a big shout out to, like, Steve Bates and Art mm-hmm. Ladd and Rob Schmidt and a number of the people who've been involved in CKW right from the start,
yeah.
who let us have a prime, like, slot for Black Masks.
Yeah.
Like, we've never been buried in the wee hours of the night right. or anything like that.
Yeah,
like,
the afternoons.
So, yeah, like, yeah. I think, like, from 3, I think maybe our first slot was 3 or something yeah. like that in the afternoon, yeah. and then it moved to 5 or whatever. But,
yeah,
like,
I think, wasn't there some rotation where you play it twice a week?
Yeah, there yeah, was a rebroadcast slot in yeah. the mornings. Yeah. So we would broadcast live on the Wednesday mm-hmm. afternoon, and then yeah. the following Tuesday morning, late morning, from, like, 10:30 to 12 would be the rebroadcast slot.
And again, also the amount of time that we got. I mean, I don't know if it started as a half-hour pro and then went to an hour, or if it's always been an hour, but then it got extended to an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Like, we got a lot of time
yeah.
to do some stuff, which was definitely, I would say, outside of the mainstream. Yeah.
The prime chunk of that broadcasting time was the key drive-home slot, too. Like, the optic of that was pretty amazing. To speak radical left politics from 4:30 to 6 every Wednesday, incredible. You know, nowhere else in Canada was that happening.
So for me, Candace, Cindy Lee Friesen, mm-hmm. and John Schlowitz, myself, Rhea Julian,
mm-hmm.
those are the people I think of really kind of off the top who mm-hmm. were, you know, heavily involved and important in getting the project started.
Yeah. And then Patrick brought Garth and myself in. And then as Patrick laterally shifted his focus to different parts of his life, and that opened up more space for the community, in the sense to allow more voices to come in, which from, you know, very close to the beginning of those years, like, this is so 03 04, we're looking at folks like Greg Wood, who is an Australian expat. Sort of, I don't know if it's taboo or risky to say that he was sort of hiding out here in Winnipeg. After meeting the propaganda guys in Australia on tour, like,
yeah.
he pulled up stakes and moved here. And was connected through the Harvest Collective and the Organic Planet crew. And folks like Joey Jacob, who was a student here, worked on the student government, like the student union, and started working and making radio here. Amber McGrath, Mondragon worker, and Organic Planet folk. Macho Filipovich, you know, Sarah Fox.
Quite a lot of a bit of a revolving yeah. door,
and then,
between the.
Well, we had lots of people who weren't necessarily regular hosts every yeah. week,
but we contribute,
but who contribute yeah. and stuff, right? And
content contributors for yeah. sure, yeah, yeah. So those mm-hmm. there were a lot of folks like that, and then there was like a second wave, almost, or third wave, I guess, maybe, in the like mid to late 2000s, when there was Garth and I. You know, our lives were expanding and changing, and we needed more support and more help. So then there was like a really strong push sort of right around when Amber and Macho were working on the show. And then Garth dropped out due to life. And then there was a big push. And the person that's most responsible for helping me keep the show on the air and active and critical was a fellow by the name of Robert McGregor. And he basically started working on the show in like late 2011 until the very end, about 3.5 years later. And we worked with a number of folks like Charlie, who worked at Mondragon and War on Music, Athena Dorning, Alex Patterson, was around for a little
bit. In 2011, Black Masked co-host Rob McGregor moderated a panel discussion on the ideas of American author, anarcho-primitivist, and radical environmentalist Derek Jensen, as captured in the then-recently released film End Civ. The following is an excerpt which addresses Jensen's apparent hypocrisy in denigrating nonviolent strategies, like trying to win over the public through written texts, as opposed to destructive activities like blowing up dams. participating in this discussion in order of appearance were Black Mask regulars Alex Patterson, Charlie Justice, and Brian Latour.
The reason writing has to be part of even a violent movement is because violence doesn't really convince people in their heads of anything. There has to be something in words, in communication, that contextualizes the act. And one of the most telling things about the movie was they showed this this image of people at one of the evangelical churches where there's like 20,000 people swaying to some evangelicist talking about God. And they use that image to tell the activists that are watching this movie that we're not going to be able to convince the culture to change. And that's why this violence is necessary. But I think one thing that has defined the non-authoritarian left is that we are trying to build with people a mass and popular movement, whereas Lopez and Jensen seem to be suggesting that that's not going to work. So in a certain way, I think that's giving up the project of the left. And I've kind of imagined Jensen recently more as like the nihilist version of Pol Pot. And I just want to say he wants to institute the Khmer Black and Green instead of the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, I see, you know, blowing up a dam. Maybe he's, you know, put a lot of reflection and thought into, you know, where that water held up by the dam, which watersheds it's going to flood into, and if and, you know, if any human or non-human creatures are going to die as a result of this. To me, just like going out and saying, let's blow up a dam seems very, I don't know, narrow-minded, let's say, and it seems to be very dangerous considering that a lot of people do take him seriously. Either way, my whole approach is that Derek Jensen's strategy is regressive. It idealizes a pre-industrial, pre-capitalist way of life. And I interpret it as, let's just, you know, destroy infrastructure physically and we will get back to this. I believe in ecology. I think the idea of primitivism parallels ecology. And yet I won't say I'm necessarily a primitivist. I'm a sympathist with it. And like we were talking about before, you know, I also believe that there's some degrees of technology that could be sustainable, some levels of concentrated populations that could be sustainable. I don't want to pretend that, you know, it's absolute on either way here. I think it's important to look at primitivism in the sort of the spectrum of ecology. That's one way I sort of have articulated it. Looking at deep ecology on one side being like the complete anti-civilization, anti-technology approach to humanity, and social ecology, long articulated by Murray Bookchin, being the approach advocating sustainable technologies and sustainable, possible sustainable infrastructure, possibly sustainable concentrated populations. So, I think Derek Jensen's violent, for lack of a better word, approach is a regressive approach, and I like to take a more progressive approach to primitivism and ecology. My term is post-complexity. I like to think that we have to, having reached this stage of industrial capitalism, choose through a self-determined mechanism or method or process to move past it, to de-industrialize to a certain degree and choose to use less technologies in order to move past markets and capitalism and help create sustainable communities. I'm not a huge fan of Derek Jensen just seemingly blindly advocating blowing up of dams.
I think this gets back to the question of violence, non-violence, and and also back to the original question of whether writing a book is helpful. I do think there are some issues with the Canadian left becoming too academic, too retreated into academia, thinking that simply throwing ideas out there without struggle is going to change things. I think that's a problem on certain sections of the left. I don't think Jensen is a hypocrite on that point, however, simply because he tried to make the point in the movie that he's not so much completely for violence, but he's against this hard, absolute doctrine of nonviolence, which entails that, you know, other people, within movements like Western liberal NGOs and that sort of thing, don't support violence, don't support any sort of direct action or resistance, and take a very negative approach while insisting everybody support their selected tactics.
I think another thing that needs to be said is that, going back to my he avoids popular and mass approaches, he does not at all talk about what it would be like of primitivists, greens, social ecologists going into unions and taking the long, hard struggle of working with those unions to show them that the industry that they're working for needs to end because it's harming the earth, and getting those workers invested and responsible in shutting down their own businesses so they don't have to blow it up. Those workers aren't there when it gets blown up. I just think he avoids doing the hardest part about what the left is all about, and that is popularizing struggle and letting the vast people that live in a place have ownership over that struggle.
Matthew Brett was around, but like a content contributor, mm-hmm. Early in his days here in Winnipeg. Prabha Pillar, who was a political visual artist, yeah. who was involved creating content and doing interviews across the world, like within the arts, radical arts community that she was connected with. Daniel Emberg, you know, CKUW All-Star alum, was working on the show. Charles Wright was active with Bar None and prison justice work in Winnipeg. Brian Latour, a fellow Wobbly of Patrick and I, was a longtime contributor for maybe a year and a half.
Did you do Palestine stuff primarily, or what was he working on?
Yeah, that and labor stuff, IWW. Yeah, that's cool. In those years, Brian was very active in organizing and bottom-lining Israeli Apartheid Week. And last but not least, Sheila Pisey Allen, who was just like amazing to be around. An incredible critical voice and an incredible energy and personality who really, really helped Garth and I, and with Macho as well, like really stabilize, like get regrounded in the next resurgence of radical activity politically in the city, and get connected with prison justice and Indigenous issues, both mainstream and the radical ones as well.
Grassy Narrows is an Indigenous community in northwestern Ontario and has maintained the longest standing blockade in Canadian history. In December 2002, Chrissy Swain was one of the youth who started the blockade to prevent logging on Grassy Narrows' traditional territory. The community recently won a victory when Abitibi Bowater announced that they would suspend logging in the territory, a major step towards establishing a moratorium on industrial development. However, resource extraction has not stopped, and I was in Grassy Narrows to attend a mining workshop organized by the community. They brought in John Cutbeat, an Indigenous activist from KI, to speak about resistance to mining in his community, and we toured three potential mining sites in the traditional territory and held ceremonies at them. In the interview, I speak to Chrissy about the youth walk she is organizing from Grassy Narrows to Ottawa to demand that the federal government honor its treaties and to make connections with other First Nations communities in resistance. The walk will leave within the next week. How could a man dismantle himself like this? Laying all alone up in that hospital lifeless. No one came to see him till he felt a rabbit's hand. Can you tell us about the walk that happened last year?
Okay, last year I did a walk from Kenora to Toronto, and the walk came out of frustration, I guess, with the way how our people get criminalized for standing up for our rights, you know, standing up to protect our territories, and it wasn't just like I guess I have to put out there that it wasn't like an idea that just came to my head. It was like something spiritual at the same time. It like came through a dream to me, and in this dream that I had, it was like I was walking, and it was early in the morning, and I knew that it was by Lake Superior, and in front of me I could see the sun rising, and I was carrying a staff, and I had my partner with me, and I just like when I thought about that dream, to me it was like that sun rising meant that there was going to be something new, like that I had to walk, you know, to find that whatever that represented. And so we did the walk, and It took us 23 days, and there was 23 youth. As we ended up on Queen's Park, we camped out there for 4 days, and there was a lot of different things that came on the walk, like a lot of visions, thoughts, messages, like for our own people and also for like non-natives, like for Canada.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and a special retrospective on the popular anarchist radio program Black Mask, the Frequency of Resistance, as part of a special summer series showcasing some of the vintage spoken word programming airing on the station over the 20 years it has occupied the public airwaves. In addition to Patrick and Ethan, we had separately contacted another personality indelibly linked to Black Mask, now living outside the province, to share his thoughts about the show and its legacy within the community.
My name is Garth Hardy, and I am currently living in Shediac, New Brunswick, which is just outside of Moncton. And I was a host of, or a co-host, I guess, of Black Mask for a period of time in the, oh boy, I want to say the mid-2000s. I had had some community radio experience. I had moved to Winnipeg from Lethbridge, and when I was attending the University of Lethbridge, I had a program on, it was then CKUL, I don't know what it's called now. Back then it was only a closed-circuit station. And when they made the jump to FM, the call letters changed. But back then it was CKUL. I had been listening to CKUW really upon arrival in Winnipeg, and I knew Patrick McGuire. We were both members of the Industrial Workers of the World, and I was looking for ways to plug into the broader scene, and Black Mass seemed like a good fit.
Were there any topics in particular that you preferred to focus on?
Well, you know, I think I tended to focus more on sort of class war, anarchist, and labor activist topics on Black Mask. And in hindsight, I think it's it was maybe one of the, it ended up being one of the weak points or the failing points during my tenure as a host, because I feel like the scope of the program became somewhat myopic and not particularly intersectional. And some of that was remedied, I think, when we brought on other co-hosts. But my own interests and my own focus and my own connections kept me in that realm. I think of myself as having a more intersectionalist position at this point. And I would credit a lot of that to people that I met at the station, and also people that I worked with on the show and got a chance to interview on the show. So I feel like it wasn't really until people like Macho Filipovic got involved and Sheila Pisey Allen, for example, that the spectrum sort of broadened a bit. And I should say that while Ethan Osland and I shared hosting duties, again, there was the focus expanded to issues of Palestinian independence and animal rights and things like that as well. Ethan certainly brought that perspective to the table. There were interviews that I look back on that I think that I was happy I got to do them. I got a chance to interview Cy Kahn, who is a folk singer and prison abolitionist, when he came through Winnipeg, and that was great. And I did an interview with Kursk, which Kursk was a grindcore band in Winnipeg, which I have really fond memories of that interview.
Do you think that punk or hardcore or grindcore or extreme music in general has the ability to raise people's consciousness? Do you think it can inform people on a radical level?
I think that the most powerful stuff that deals with that sort of thing, I mean, obviously, everything that's going on now has benefited from decades of bands writing whatever way that they write, whether it's political or not political, or just, you know, kind of putting themselves in the context of whatever scene is going on at the time or regionally where they're at and what's going on in their lives. But I guess to get back to the question, at this point, I think it's tough. It's tough to come out and actually say something that people haven't heard a whole bunch of times, and to say it in a way that relates to an actual view of the world around you that people aren't just going to, you know, it's hard to make it so that it's not one-dimensional. I think there's a lot of potential for provoking thought. I think there's a lot of potential for provoking examinations of different things that are going on around, especially these days. People have so much access to information that I think, you know, for myself personally, the things that I appreciate the most in that vein are things that make me look at something a little bit differently or make me consider a different facet, or the way that something I'm already reading about on the internet fits in with my worldview or what's going on locally around me in my community or with my friends or anything like that. So I think it's kind of at the point now where if you're going to come out and start writing stuff like that, you kind of have to put that extra effort into it to make it into a message that means something to people beyond just like reciting an idea and expecting people to soak it up and take it on for themselves and have it alter part of their life.
In terms of other interviews that were done that I thought were standouts, Macho Filipovic interviewed Justin Poder. That was a great one.
First of all, if you want to describe a little bit for people listening who might not have heard of the Free Software Movement before, what exactly, or even just generally sketch what that means?
Yeah. On free software stuff, I generally follow Richard Stallman because there's a lot of different takes on it. There's open source, but Stallman insists on very specific wording for things. So you can't call it Linux, you have to call it GNU plus Linux. Mm-hmm. You can't call it open source, you have to call it free software. And the way Stallman talks about it is in terms of the four freedoms, 0 through 3. Mm-hmm. And so any software, you should be able to look at the code, look at the source code, modify it, copy it, and share it. I think those are the freedoms. And the idea is that there's something about information. I mean, the difference between information and another kind of thing, like a cookie. If I give you a cookie, I no longer have the cookie. Mm-hmm. If I give you a recipe, I still have the recipe. And so sharing information is different from sharing goods. And the whole concept of stealing information is kind of a bankrupt notion, because you can't steal it from somebody because they still have it after you've mm-hmm. stolen it. And so all of the legal and political and governmental mechanisms that are in place to prevent the stealing of information and to control information are pushing against the nature of information, and also pushing against democracy and pushing against transparency and pushing against efficiency mm-hmm. from the point of view of people who develop software or scientists or anybody who's interested in any of these things, culture, art. These things should be free, and people should be able to build on them, and people should be able to take them and grow from them. The way I understand free software as far as social movements go, I just think it's I think there's a natural fit, because the alternative to using free software and helping to be part of a community that develops it and and so on is to use corporate software, and which gets you into the politics of trying to control information and having to, and capitalism is like that. Mm-hmm. Markets are like that. You, if you're in a market, you have to try to control, you have to try to restrict access to whatever it is you're selling in order to force people to pay for it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to be part of that whole process, then in the realm of information, you're into the free software movement.
Mm-hmm. Ethan's interview with Billy Bragg, I think, is just a standout music interview. I think in terms of like an anarchist perspective, it maybe, you know, didn't quite fit the bill for that, but the interview itself was just great. I think that Ethan, you know, he got a chance to ask Billy questions that I don't think he is often normally asked, and it was just a really solid interview.
There's an acknowledged aspect of your songwriting that is very romantic.
Oh yeah.
And as a romantic fellow, can you talk about the importance of maintaining that type of emotional connection to the listener?
Sure. Well, the thing about writing political songs is you're alienating half the audience immediately, because just on averages they're bound to disagree with you. Nothing wrong with that. You need to be a bit provocative. But there are things that are more important than politics. And among them, as well as football, are the human condition. And no artist of any worth can afford to not reflect that. And life is not all politics. Life is not all love. Life is not all anything. It's a great variety of anything. So if you decide to just be a political songwriter only, you paint yourself into a corner. I used to do gigs with a band called the Redskins in England, who were a really hardcore political band who I had a huge amount of respect for. We did loads of gigs during the miners' strike. They always drank my beer while I was on stage, but I forgive them for that. In fact, I wouldn't even mention it 20, 30 years later. And but their politics made them never, ever play a love song, ever. And it broke my heart, because one time at a live gig, they played a song of mine, Levi Stubbs' Tears, and it was recorded and it ended up on an album. It was so beautiful, because they were such hard guys politically. For them to show that bit of tenderness was just, in fact, it moves me now just to talk about it. Not the fact that it was my song. It probably, if they'd have recorded anything that was a love song, it would have had that same effect. But to deny that side. Antonio Gramsci, who's the father of Italian Eurocommunism, when he was in prison, wondered if it had affected his ability as a socialist, the fact that he had never been able to love people, he'd never been able to love his immediate family, and that lack of emotion, that lack of love, had somehow undermined his ability as a socialist. Because, you know, ultimately, the politics that we on the left believe in, whatever you want to call them, whatever level they're at, you know, they are fundamentally nothing more than organized compassion. If they're not, then they're totalitarianism. And when you talk about compassion, it has no limits. Even the church uses compassion, all of us, ultimately. That's the way that we make a difference in the world and express something beyond our own little self.
Just in terms of other things that stick out or have stuck with me, we were often towing the line on you know, what could be said on the airwaves. We were very critical of the police, and to the point that the station received a complaint from the Winnipeg Police Service over comments that I had made, and I don't even quite remember what the comments were. Something along the lines of a brick in a cop's face, or something like that. Anyways, they got a complaint, and it is something that will always stick with me, in that the station backed us and didn't back down. and didn't acquiesce. Rob Schmidt held his ground, and I will always remember that. It was a real stand-up thing to do.
Was it the service itself or the union?
I can't remember.
I think it was the union.
Yeah.
Their rep or their lawyer called.
Yeah.
Or emailed.
Yeah. So
that was.
There's been a couple moments like that that were fun.
Yeah, and for me specifically, the one of note that I can recall off the top of my head, and we were speaking about it this weekend, happened within the first year and a half of me working on the show. Around that time, I was also beginning to be very active with a local Palestine solidarity group called the Canada Palestine Support Network, and the sister group of that organization called the International Solidarity Movement, which is a Palestinian-led nonviolent direct action group leading solidarity campaigns within the occupied Palestinian territories. And so I went to the West Bank for the summer of 2004, and not just on Black Mask, but on other shows. When Jeffrey Young, who is a great comrade and supporter and champion of the show, he and other folks would call and we would do live to air interviews or pre-records or whatever. And also, on air during mm-hmm. Black Mask. And there was, you know, calls of like, you know, anti-Semitism, internally within the station's community. And I got to say that, without a real grounded understanding about free speech and just political realities in general, from the community and also the key components of the staff here at the station, speaking particularly about Rob Schmidt again.
Other people would have buckled.
Yeah. But Rob, for those that know him and have worked with him, he doesn't suffer foolishness lightly. And when he sees nonsense, he has no problem calling it out in a very professional and deliberate way. And it taught, for me, working on that show, a lot about the work that we're doing. And it's not always flinging Molotovs, like literally or allegorically, at things to get change. Sometimes you have to get in the trenches and work with and work people, you know, to get, you know, change to happen. And so that whole process of, like, we see people being charged with accusations of anti-Semitism today, and they, like, they're, whatever they're doing, it's, they're basically erased. Like, they disappear and that's it. Like, it doesn't, the way the online world works today, it's like, it's the worst smear that you could have in a radical left. And you have to have a ton of support that's strategic. It's a very serious accusation. And as a radical left person, nothing could have been further from the truth. So how do you then take that accusation and spin it into solidarity? So that was part of the work that we had to do very early on in working on the show. And that framework and Rob's focus and dedication to justice, which is representative within the framework of this entire station and this community here.
Lots of other great spoken word programs.
Oh, yeah.
Uncovering all types of
Say
issues.
It, Sista,
in the station.
You know?
System Kids.
System Kids, absolutely. Yeah.
So many.
Maybe just to invite you to talk about maybe if there's a particular show moment, whether it's a favorite interview or something that happened behind the scenes that really sticks out in your memory all these years later.
I absolutely have one.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, I have to go for.
This is great.
This is one of the weirdest ones. So longtime listeners and people on the left are probably familiar with Michael Albert. He's an author and a media creator, ZMI Institute, Z Magazine, ZNet, yeah. ZNet, all that stuff. One of the kind of ideological developers of Paracon or participatory economics, which inspired almost all of the worker co-ops in the last 20 years in Winnipeg. So I was interviewing him one time. This would have been, I don't know, I want to say 2000, something like that. And I'm doing my show exactly the way I always do my show, which is, you know, 15-minute interview, song, 15-minute mm-hmm. interview, song. And so I get to the second song break, and I go off air, and I'm talking to him on the phone because it's a radio interview. He's in Boston. And I say, how's this going? Everything okay? And he says, this is going absolutely terrible. This is complete amateur hour. I hope you don't treat Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky like this when you interview them. And I say, what do you mean? Like, what's going on? He's like, why are you playing all this music? And I said, well, you know, my show's format is that we do an interview, but then we have musical breaks. Like, it's kind of orally demanding to, like, expect people to listen to, like, a 45 or a straight hour of interview. Like, we always take musical breaks. Like, well, why don't we just get back to this interview, and then I can finish my time, and you can play whatever music you want. I'm like, oh, okay, sure, sounds good. And so I faded the song out and then went back into the interview and did another 10 minutes of interview and wrapped it up. But, the time I got dressed down off air by Michael Albers, one of the most memorable moments. And the funniest thing about it is that when we went back, it was right around the time of all the summits. So, like, the counter-protests against globalization, free trade deals that were happening in Seattle and Washington and Quebec City. So it was right around that time. And so the left was kind of in a bit of a moment, right, where we were seeing lots of thousands of people coming in who were not involved. And so, people who'd kind of in the trenches doing it for years had kind of this interesting what do we do with all these new people? Like, how do we bring them in? And so I was doing an interview with him about that. And so he's like, well, we have to be really welcoming and we have to kind of find them a place to be and really kind of approach them in a non-judgmental way. I just remember him saying this stuff like literally 30 seconds or 40 seconds after he chewed me out off air. So anyways, that was one of my favorite moments. I mean, I have a lot of appreciation for the work that Michael Albert's done.
Yeah.
And maybe my show is not the exact same format as alternative radio, just the David Barsimian program out of Boulder. That was definitely one of my most memorable moments is, to have someone who you really respect and you kind of see as an elder doing an interview with them, oh, I got this great interview. And then they're you're really messing this up right now.
Yeah.
That would certainly crush me, especially in a live scenario.
Right. But that was probably one of the weirdest things that ever happened. On the show for me. Actually, sorry, do you want to tell the Noraki story?
You go.
Okay. Well, and then your turn.
I've got a story.
You do yours and I'll do mine.
Yeah. You close with the Noraki.
Sure. Okay.
You know, when maybe you feel similarly in all your years as a reporter, as a journalist, but also as the news director here at the station, and you're trying to get grounded in issues that matter and you want people to be drawn to them. And sometimes you feel like you're losing your mooring. You know, your connection to people and to the issues, you know, it's a common thing because sometimes it feels like you're just screaming at the dark, you know, or
you have no idea who's listening at all.
Yeah.
You're just in a box talking in a mic and hoping someone's tuning in.
100%, you know, and it affects you. But to our movement's credit, the people, the listeners, they really knew how to support what they were listening to every year. It was built into the fabric, not only of the show, but also of this station, that every year our listeners would do their bit and support and keep this station going by contributing financially to the station in whatever form that they could. We've had pledges during the funding drive of as little as $1 or sometimes even less to as high as there was a block of years when Propagandy annually, as part of their dedication to solidarity and revolutionary politics, they had an annual donation of $666. Mm. And that was standard. And we, sometimes we would prompt and sometimes we wouldn't. They would just, maybe we got busy and then we would forget. And then there it would be.
It's become pretty routine.
You know, and you see who out there is serious about the issues that you're talking about, whether it's Black Mask or, anything else. Pick a program, and I think that was probably the most heartfelt and consistently heartwarming expression of solidarity for all the work that we did here, 52 weeks out of the year. Sure, you'd have incredible interviews and incredible moments of content, but to really see the community that express their support in that way, to put their, to not just talk the talk,
And who would come in and play? It's who's who of all of our friends and local musicians and stuff. Greg McPherson.
Ian LaRue.
Yeah.
Sometimes we would do on the 5-year calendar for Propagandy, they would come in and talk about the new record and the 1919s, the band that Patrick and Garth had, singing old labor tunes, and that they would come in. Lots of folks Break Bread crew, like
Pipskid, Yai, Gruff,
McEnroe. Yeah, a lot of different ways and expressions of solidarity. It was really amazing. I get overwhelmed by it sometimes about, you know, thinking back and reflecting on all those times and the people that we were able to interact with and become friends with and do work with. It's still, you know, active. It's just different now.
As far as how you're going to connect with the audience, are you interested in inciting people? Are you interested in entertaining and educating in some combination? Are there more things?
I want to get them excited, you know, and I want to get them all psyched up and worked up and ready to go out there and make love and start riots and revolution.
So Norman Norosky of Montreal, who's involved with rhythm activism and then with Bakunin's Bum and a whole bunch of other things. He was in town doing, what was it called? I Just Don't Understand Women, I think is what the play was. But he had this series of plays that he was doing that were specifically aimed at college students or university students, young men, around issues of sexual assault and consent. And so he had this kind of traveling show that he was doing. We're talking about sexuality and all this stuff, but he never wanted to do it in like a heavy-handed kind of like, you know, do this, don't do that type of way, right? And so I can't remember how it started, but he's just like, you know I said like, we're back with Norman Rotsky and we're having a great time. He's like, yes, we're three naked guys at a radio station here. We're just having a wonderful time and you should be coming. I'm so glad you're tuning in to hear us, you know, having so much fun and excitement. But anyways, there's just like just kind of goofy things like that. We're thinking about him being so silly. I actually just saw him when he was in town 3 weeks ago, right? Yeah, for his Women's Strike production that he just put on, which was excellent.
So,
the goofy stuff, right? The lighter stuff, the human stuff.
Yeah.
That's what really made the station and the black mask really kind of mean something.
Yeah.
Lots of memories.
The ability to have happiness and joy within the context of really heavy things, you know, like, issues that are still very prominent today, like, You contemplate Mumia Abu-Jamal or Leonard Peltier, that's how I learned about those issues and about the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army and AIM, American Indian Movement, was through this show before I started working on it. And all of those issues are still, they're still active. Some of those issues have not changed. But the awareness has grown, you know. Mm. And when we talk specifically about, like, the pre-internet wave that we're experiencing with social media, like, things started changing, you know, closer to the end of the... with Twitter and other formats, right? But, like, when the show started, and we were talking about this before we started recording with you about how, like, the show was recorded on cassette, you know? And then my biggest blunder in the early years was, like, I didn't know that I had to buy a new cassette from Rob. And after the show, you were like, why aren't there any new cassettes? I'm like, what are you talking about? I just knew that I had to put a cassette in there and record the show for the rebroadcast next Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and you're like, what happened to all the content? But yeah, stuff like that. But I think it's, you know, I love that expressions of radical politics are fluid. And that things like CKW are still around to help get those voices out there, whether it's direct to the airwaves or online. I think it's an incredible thing. So, thank you for 20 years. That's amazing.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick McGuire, Ethan Osland, it's been great to have you back on the
Thanks
airwaves.
Thanks for having us.
Maybe we can coerce you into producing some more radio for us in the future.
Oh, tempt.
Yeah, exactly. Slippery slope.
Yeah.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
You just heard a retrospective look at the anarchist show Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance, part of a summer series profiling the vintage spoken word programming airing on the station. The series is part of CKUW's celebration of 20 years on the FM dial. Much of the audio airing on today's show is available for download at the site radioforall.net. Just search using the keyword Black Mask. If you wish to leave feedback on today's show, please email our program director, Sam Doucette, at programming@ckuw.ca or phone 204-786-9782. Thank you for joining us. Please tune in again next week to hear more excerpts from our station's past. My name is Michael Welch.